In her book, The Second Sex, as response to the question, what is a woman, Beauvoir writes, quote, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. No biological, psychological, or economic fate determines the figure that the human female presents in society. It is civilization as a whole that produces this creature, intermediate between male and eunuch, which is described as feminine, unquote. What do you think of this?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that Beauvoir is partly right and mostly wrong in the way she describes women. That is, there is always in men and women some aspect of our character that comes from nature. There are certain tendencies that are grounded in the male and female bodies and in male and female psychologies that are like difficult to erase, impossible to erase. On the other hand, our constitution, you know, the way that we interpret what men and women should be, our understanding of gender, as I talk about more broadly, does make women and men into one thing or another. Depending on what kind of a political community you live in, men can be soldiers, they can be Spartans, or they can be businessmen like they are in America. There's a lot of flexibility into what a man will be. And there is also some flexibility in what women will be. 300 years ago, lots of women became nuns. Now, almost no women become nuns. So I think that, you know, that what Beauvoir does is take that idea that there's a lot that society does to shape men and women and just hits the gas pedal on it and says, all we are is what society makes of us. And that goes way too far. It takes a sensible idea way too far. And and this leads her into, I would say, boatloads of other errors in her thought.
So you seem to be suggesting that she's going too far. So let's start with how much of it do you kind of maybe you can meet with her? Like, where do you, till what argument or till what aspects do you agree with her, and where do you think the disagreement starts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is flexibility within what men and women will be, but not infinite flexibility. The fuzzy line between what men and women can be and what they are is, you know, impossible to nail precisely down. But we do know that it exists. So for instance, I think the easiest place to see this is in athletic competitions. The fastest women today are faster than the fastest men 100 years ago. But the fastest men today are way faster than the fastest women today. So there's obviously some great, you know, changes that can that society, through kind of, in this particular case, training, can cultivate, you know, like in this case, speed in ways that it didn't before. But on the other hand, the difference remains. So the way I think about it is that sex is a limit on what gender, which is society's way of imagining sex, can accomplish. And society's understanding of gender should always travel within the grooves of what sex, you know, teaches us about men and women. There are other ways of looking at the same thing, I think, Ryan. You can see this in occupations. Men tend to congregate in occupations that really involve things, lonely work, difficult work, things like installing electrical cords, being an electrician, being a plumber, being a trucker. It's almost all men. Women aren't interested in those things. And we have tried. We have invested lots of money to encourage women to join such professions. And there are professions on the other side, the most prominent being something like a nurse, or an elementary school teacher, which are very predominantly female professions. And those involve children or people. And so there's real tendencies for women to congregate in those kinds of jobs and men to congregate in other kinds of jobs. We shouldn't like think that that's a problem to be solved. That's what Beauvoir treats it as, a problem to be solved. Whereas if we realize that gender always travels within the grooves of sex, we can accept these different changes or different roles that men and women have in society and see them as pretty natural byproducts of how men and women are different.
In terms of like the occupation, you seem to be suggesting that men naturally gravitate to these kind of occupations, let's say by plumbers, or let's say, managerial positions or leadership positions, and women might be more interested in, let's say, nurturing or nursing positions, or where there is a inherent human element to the occupation, and they excel at those kind of professions. But I think these, encapsulate everyone's arguments, I'll just call them like the feminist argument. Let me know if that's the wrong term. So these feminists might push back saying, the women have not had such positions of power, or they have not had a chance at the occupation. But I think you discussed in your earlier answer as well, that is not the case. Like even when they're given the chance as to well to choose, it seems like women do tend to gravitate towards these kind of professions. Is that fair? Am I getting that right?
Yes, I think that's fair. I mean, I can use an example. With airline pilots, there's a lot of movement right now among American airlines to encourage more women and more minorities to become pilots. The strange thing is that there have been such programs really like spending a lot of money trying to get recruits since 1980. That's more than 40 years. And the number of female pilots has not changed. Some women want to do it, but the number is just nothing compared to men who want to do it. And why is that? Well, I mean, part of it is the technological focus of men and the embrace of danger that is more in line with the male character. There are plenty of programs, I haven't written about this in public, but plenty of programs to encourage women to be electrical engineers or electricians. They don't do it. And when they go into engineering, they generally go into something like environmental engineering. Why? Well, it's just like they probably can do it. They can do it, but it's not where their true passions for professions lie. So they generally select out of such things. And so like no one denies that they have the capacity to do it. It's that it's a lower priority, or it's less like in their wheelhouse than other things. The women who can be engineers, as I say, which is many of them, end up preferring not to be often. And they have other talents. Whereas men who are engineers often have fewer talents and follow their, the grooves of sex into that particular profession. I think there are a lot of examples of this. And the engineering, the pilots, those are just some of them.
I think your answer will remain the same, but I just want to push this point a little on a different example, maybe. In the sense that I think when I hear people talk about, in computer science courses or in the field of computer science, I think there is generally a lot of push to welcome more female engineers and maybe add a little, since the field is generally dominated by men, computer science, there's a lot of encouragement, or there's a lot of propensity for people in let's say administration or universities, they generally tend to push for women to join CS. So even one or two cases where I've heard at least first person testimonials is like, there is some intimidation, as like the field is already dominated by men, so there might be some hesitation on their part to like join the field. Even there, you feel like those might be the isolated cases, in the sense that sure, there are women who would want to be engineers, but broadly most of them may not be interested. Is that fair, or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. I think what you say is fair. The there are a lot of programs to encourage women and young girls to become engineers. And very few, if any, engineering departments around the country would not salivate at having more and more females among their students. And the fact that it doesn't happen in the numbers that they are interested in is an interesting and revealing fact. Another thing is that the females who go into engineering have much higher dropout rates than the males who go into engineering. The girls are encouraged to get into it. These programs exist to create a pipeline, as they say, from K through 12 to higher ed in engineering. And engineering is hard, so one expects the dropout rates to be high for both men and women, but they're, you know, like significantly higher for females than males, like something to the effect of 40% for females drop out and change, but while 25% of males do. Like those numbers are approximate, and who knows what they have been in the last few years. The way I look at it is that females have generally, the testing shows, have a broader range of skill sets than males. So they have like greater choices in what they can do. They often have higher verbal skills than men and, you know, often just as good of math skills as men. Whereas men with math skills often do not have great verbal skills. And so the fact that women, you know, enter engineering, are encouraged to enter it, and drop out at higher rates is really just a reflection of the fact that they have a lot more options. Given their own natures and given the openness of our economy to the variety of talents.
So why, so if this is the case, then why are people not willing to accept this in the sense that why are people still pushing for more equality? Like even if it is shown that people may not have interest in particular fields, why push people in those fields? Why do you think that's happening?
Yeah, the feminist assumption, that is Beauvoir's assumption, that women are made, not born, is widely accepted in the modern world. So all disparities, especially those disparities in prestigious jobs that do not favor, that where the inequity is against the woman, those are immediately suspect. So the amount of energy that society puts into getting a 50-50 like legal profession or a 50-50 medical profession or a 50-50 engineering program is immense, because those professions all had disparities between the numbers of men and the numbers of women for a long time, and they're prestigious professions. The feminists do not spend a lot of time trying to get rid of inequities in plumbers and truck drivers and electricians, because those are less prestigious things. And so that's an interesting fact, and it does tell us something about what the feminist ambition is. They're only interested in equality when it comes to prestigious jobs, not unprestigious jobs, which shows that the whole movement is really concerned with who gets to rule society. So the assumption of socialization being the prominent explainer for the difference between men and women is just a means to a certain kind of end about securing the rule of women in prestigious professions and probably broadly in society.
You started with saying, it seems like Beauvoir has won the culture war, is it? Like, I mean, in the sense that if this view is dominant, does it mean that she has won the intellectual war in that sense?
Yes. I mean, I think that that people don't live as much according to Beauvoir's philosophy as they think according to her philosophy. And the evidence that this is a widely shared set of intellectual assumptions is seen in today's transgender movement. If a woman is made and is not born, then, well, what is a woman? Whatever we make her. And she need not be a woman in the old sense. And the paper that, you know, is kind of the grounding of our discussion today tries to explain how transgenderism kind of naturally grows out of Beauvoir's assumptions that have been, you know, so widely influential in the feminist movement. It's hard to ultimately, I think, to divorce modern feminism from the transgender movement precisely because of the presence of that assumption that it is all socialization.
So the second sex, the book by Beauvoir, you feel like that is pivotal. I mean, that is very that's a very important book when looking at these ideas or these events that have happened, is it?
Yeah, I think it's a very important book. I mean, you know, very few people go as far as Beauvoir on as many issues as she does. And often feminists who are trying to get things done in the public square will disclaim having the radical ambitions that Beauvoir herself has. They'll disclaim it. But the policies that they're pushing are almost without exception the next stage in achieving Beauvoir's ambition. I call her like a rolling revolutionary. That is, she set forth a revolution that keeps going. It's an endless, difficult to accomplish revolution. And that most politicians and judges are just achieving the next role in the revolution that she kind of announced. No one is as radical as she is, or very few people are as radical as she is. There are some people who are even more radical. But they all are, you know, living in her odor and achieving the ambitions that she articulated in the book.
Why do you think she resonated so much? Like, why was she so successful? Wasn't there anybody before her who made those arguments? Were people not receptive to it? Was it the timing of the book that probably was, you know, she was lucky with the timing where people were ready to accept these ideas? Why do you think she struck a chord?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, I think on the one hand, her thought is kind of in line with certain modern ambitions. You know, Francis Bacon talked about conquering nature and relieving man's estate. And feminism is, and Bacon wrote in the 1630s, and 20s and 30s. And, you know, that ambition became more and more deeply embedded in Western civilization as an aim of our civilization. You know, think of when Beauvoir wrote the book. It's in the early 1950s. It's the late 40s. It was published in France. In the early 1950s, it was published in the United States after it was translated. You know, the A-bomb is blowing up. and you know, so there are real attempts to conquer nature and to harness her for modern ambitions and political ambitions. And her articulation of conquering the nature of man and woman and creating a new kind of man and a new kind of woman really fits in with that time and with that modern ambition. On the other hand, the things that really restrained human beings before, I'll say, the Second World War, you know, a real commitment to traditional family life and a corresponding religious belief that believed that there was limits on what human beings can and should conquer through their exertions of power, were beginning to wane. And Beauvoir is like providing a philosophy for a post-religious society that is interested in conquering nature. And such a society really didn't exist in large part before her book, came out. And after it came out, it helps kind of accelerate the ambitions in both respects. So, so we can think about this in just two ways. One, contraception is something that frees women from natural biology. And obviously she was a very big advocate of that. And another thing that frees women is abortion. And she celebrates abortion. She, in like a 40-page discussion of how abortion on demand creates a new kind of ethic for a post-Christian world that she is very interested in bringing about. So, you know, I do think there was kind of a woman meets moment. And her thought is very influential because both those upward and downward trajectories were happening at the same time.
So I'll tell you where I feel like I'm sympathetic to this view, in the sense that when you were talking about conquering nature, so there is one aspect of conquering nature. The other aspect you spoke about earlier, how most of the profession, like when I look at most of the professions today, most of the prestige professions that you spoke of are generally dominated by men. In that case, even if the other gender is not equipped or not very like inherently interested, shouldn't it, because those are prestige professions and those are powerful professions, is it okay to motivate people or to incentivize people to join those professions, or to make sure that women end up participating in those professions, just to make sure that they also have some power dynamic there, where at this point it seems to be dominated by men? Is that fair? I don't know.
Well, I mean, at this point, I don't think any of those professions are particularly dominated by men. Certainly the legal profession is not, and the medical profession is not. And it's, you know, I would say computers and technology probably is a sphere where male dominance, there probably is about 80-20 in most professions, aside from civil engineering. And that probably won't change, I would guess. I mean, look, I don't think that there are extraordinary pathologies in professions that have like lots of men in them. I don't think you're going to find that those are incompetent or unable to achieve their ends. So if you think about them from the perspective of whether or not they get the job done, having a male-dominated profession, like, it's not an obstacle. Female opportunity is a different question than whether or not the profession is ultimately a competent profession, I would say.
I want to explore what you touched on earlier, which is so Beauvoir's thoughts and ideas. What impact did it have on, let's say, family life, or family life / family values? How has it kind of changed over the years, maybe?
Yeah. Well, the way I would say that is it's just kind of simple. That is, before modern feminism, before the iteration of feminism that, you know, was inspired by Beauvoir's work, the priority for women was to be mothers and wives and homemakers. And the second wave of feminism that Beauvoir kicked off basically said that that was a world of slavery and Sisyphean tasks and not worth the dignity of women investing their time and identity in. And since then, kind of not surprisingly, every generation, there's been less and less attachment to motherhood, wifeliness, and homemaking. And at some point, the future of civilization is actually threatened by the the dishonoring of motherhood, wifelyhood, wifeliness, and homemaking. And the hope that they always had was that men would simply kind of take over that task. It's not going to work out like that if sex is a real thing and gender has to run within the grooves of sex. And in some countries, we are really achieving the point of crisis on this matter. So the countries that, you know, you can really put on the list here are, I would say, are the countries of East Asia. South Korea is the most important of them, or most revealing. There, the birth rate is getting to be like historically low, and fewer people are interested in being mothers, wives, and homemakers. And as a result, like, the future of the country is at risk. And I think that is kind of a logical endpoint of the rolling revolution that Beauvoir, sets kicking off with her great book.
The debate, maybe, let's say, on abortion today, do you see that as like a symptom of the war, or like, you know, is as part of the part of this war as well?
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, I do think that it, you know, is overrated.
What do you mean?
Well, the crucial thing about abortion being legal and celebrated is that it detaches female identity from motherhood. It makes motherhood not only into a choice, but into a, you know, condition of biological slavery. And I am interested in securing the life of the unborn, like, don't get me wrong, but the cultural influence of abortion being kind of widely accepted is on shaping female identity away from motherhood and toward, like, optional, seeing babies as options. And so what you'll see, I think, is that over the course of generations, women come to have the opinion that abortion is necessary to become full and participating members of society. And that is based on the idea that there should be no connection between sex and gender. And so I do think that the primary long-term threat of abortion isn't just in, you know, like, killing the unborn, but it's in shaping our attitudes toward children and mothers. And in that sense, I think the feminists are right in seeing, and this is what Beauvoir argues, that abortion is necessary to get women to be a lot less interested in being mothers. And I think that's a bad thing. She thinks it's a good thing. And she thinks the future of female identity and health is based on that idea. I think society and women's health in a different way is threatened by that idea. But I do think that she is correct in thinking that abortion has profound implications for how women imagine themselves into the future.
The abortion debate also has like a religious element to it. I want to, like, what is the, do the feminists discard the religious view? Are they, do they rally against religious views, or do they take, do they inculcate these religious views and make their arguments as well?
Yeah, they'll do both those things up to a point. I mean, for the most part, you'd have to say that people like Beauvoir and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the great Supreme Court justice of feminism, are critics of how all revealed religions interpret womanhood. And they're all critics of that. Now, there are people on the ground today within churches who kind of agree broadly with, we'll say, Beauvoir and Ginsburg, but they're not going, like, hitting the gas pedal and going all the way to the floor on their views, they are kind of gradually seeking to transform religious belief from within. So in Christianity, it is pretty clear from this, you know, strict reading of the Bible that women should not be pastors. And what you'll do is you'll have people within particular religious denominations who try to like say that's only poetical or metaphoric and argue that women should be pastors. And that's transforming the religion from within. They've already done that in many kind of mainline church bodies with abortion and with other elements of the queer constitution that we have. And, you know, they also have done it in many church bodies with the position of females. And then they'll translate that to the family. And then they'll translate it to the demand for social justice or civil rights reform. And so there is a transformation of religion that some of them play within the whole context, I would say, of the broader rolling revolution that Beauvoir, you know, announced and wanted to pursue.
Was there a counterforce to like Beauvoir in the sense when she was advocating for her ideas? Was there a similar, was there anyone with that kind of a force or intellect maybe who was maybe having opposite views?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's a real interesting fact that the level of intellectual pushback against Beauvoir and other associated feminists from the 1960s in America, like Betty Friedan, was not real substantial. I would locate three books that were written in the early 70s, which were pretty intelligent critics of this wave of feminism. One of them is George Gilder's Sexual Suicide. Another is Midge Decker's book called The New Chastity. And another was Goldberg's book called The Inevitability of Patriarchy. All of these books were united in the view that nature would prove too strong, and therefore nature itself would resist the feminist revolution. And that ends up not being true. You need a culture that interprets nature differently than the feminist world. And so there were intellectual pushback, but it ended up being ineffectual because they thought nature like didn't have to be interpreted. That's what Beauvoir gets right. Like society matters in shaping men and women, but society runs within the grooves of nature. Moreover, another illustration of the point is that in the early 70s, I think it was 1973, Congress passed an amendment to the United States Constitution called the Equal Rights Amendment, which was supposed to eliminate all discrimination on the basis of sex in both the national and state governments. Both the political parties embraced that plank. That amendment, every presidential candidate for the next couple of elections embraced that idea. Even President Reagan, who opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA, you know, I would say allocated equal time to those who favored it in his ways of talking about it in public. So this, however, did not pass. The Equal Rights Amendment was not ratified by the states, which showed that there was kind of a mass level pushback against it in the country then. I would say today it would pass. if it were suggested today, it would pass. And that is a testament to the progress that feminism has made in shaping public opinion in the United States.
We started off like, I think she wrote the book in the 1940s, if I'm not wrong. You touched on this earlier, but if you can paint us a picture in the sense of like real world implications of how this, like how, what kind of changes have we seen maybe in day-to-day life with the way things were done and maybe are done today, maybe with laws, or just with, you know, people talking about it, you know, maybe some things that you can say or you cannot say, or some things that you can talk about or cannot talk about. How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, well, that's like an endless, I can give an endless answer to this one. You know, the world before what we'll broadly call the feminist or sexual revolution is a lost world, a totally different world than the one we live in today. Totally different. Every aspect of life is different. Look at old movies that were made in the 40s and 50s. People dressed better. Females dressed modestly. Men dressed for respectability, not comfort. The talk was different. People were more formal. Miss, Mr., Mrs. Divorce was very uncommon in, you know, that earlier period. Many women worked outside the home, but their identity was essentially to become mothers and wives and to make homes with work on the side. We had laws that channeled men into responsible positions. There was a law in Idaho. I live in Idaho, for instance, that designated that fathers would be the default executors of their children's estate if their children died. Like, men are in charge of finances. And it was common for employers, when they were seeking employees, to specify whether they wanted men or women in this particular role. And so the laws prescribed roles for husbands and wives within marriage. Employers tried to reinforce those roles by hiring men for certain kinds of jobs and women for other kinds of jobs. Many employers paid what they called a family wage, so they'd give men more pay because they were the head of a household and their wives weren't working. So it'd be easy for them to sustain their jobs. Employers had practices where they would not hire mothers with young children because they wanted to encourage women to stay home with those young children. It is a totally different world now. None of those things, you know, persists in the world today. We don't say policeman, we say police what? Person? We don't say fireman, we say what? Fire person? We've changed the regulations as to what people have to do to become a policeman or a fireman in order to accommodate greater inclusion of women. The idea that men, husbands and wives have different roles within the family is now unconstitutional. It is a civil rights violation for employers to say they want a man or a woman for any particular job. Divorce is widely accepted, so widely accepted and so widely practiced that you can't even talk about it what kind of deleterious effects it might have. You know, whereas people dressed modestly in the past, bikinis are the norm now, and those are less modest than what people used to wear. I think it's a totally different world. You know, there were a lot of sex-segregated spaces in the world in 1940, say. The military, men's clubs, the Lions Club. Now all of those things are integrated and segregated. Institutions are under tons of pressure to change their manner of operating. So yeah, I think it is a totally different world. Like, the internet changed things, but I don't think it changed things as much as the sexual revolution in this respect.
So I have a weird question, which is there, could it also be at least partly that you have the fear of losing power, maybe, in the sense of when you spoke about those examples, could it be that that men are being less powerful as the decades go by? Do you think that fear is there?
Well, the reality is there. And I can see that.
But does that make you fearful?
It depends on what you mean by that. Personally, it doesn't make me fear for my personal safety. It does make me think that the future of civilization is at risk. And I think maybe it would be bad if civilization collapsed. So if that is a fear, then I suppose I have that fear. I mean, I try to, like, my reasoning on this, I try to keep, like, I'm concerned about the future of civilization. And I believe that the family is necessary to support civilization. And there are limits to how much you can mess with the family and still have it function. And the family, just like work professions, needs to run within the grooves of sex, and which means that men and women are going to do some different things within the family. And I believe that society should do what it can in whatever circumstance you are in to support those different things. And that is the plank that feminism puts under pressure. It withdraws public support that there might be different roles for men and women within families. And if you propagate that view, it will ultimately, in my view, be difficult to sustain family life. And without family life, you'll have a difficulty sustaining civilization.
Do you think that feminism has become, has gotten more radical over the years? Or do you think it was most radical in the 40s, 50s, and now what we are seeing may not be as radical as it can be or as it is?
No, I would say that feminism has become more institutionalized since the 40s and 50s. But it's carrying out the same project as Beauvoir announced in the 40s and 50s. By being institutionalized, it is an ideology that is achieving its goals one piece at a time. But it's doing so under the purview of the established order. So it doesn't look as revolutionary. It looks like it's just pursuing the next thing but there is, I think, a more revolutionary long-term plan that most events are, and most of these policy turns are following. So Beauvoir's radicalism wasn't institutionalized when she announced it, and it appeared as an outsider policy, but now it is integrated on the inside as one of the major commitments of our ruling elite in America. So it looks like it's been tamed, but in the larger view, it is just carrying out the revolution.
Was there a moment in, like, when you look at the culture wars, or when you think about the culture wars, do you see it as a natural progression from 40s, 50s, and, you know, up till the present day? Or was there a particular incident or a moment in time that you thought that it had really intensified, or, you know, the tides really began to shift?
Yeah, I think there are moments of, like, explosive reform and change, followed by periods of consolidation. And you can see the periods of great change in things like the early 70s, the early 1970s in America. You got no-fault divorce. You got the civil rights expansion through the Supreme Court. You got the Equal Rights Amendment passed. You got Title IX of the Education Amendments passed. And then over the next, like, two decades, all of those, I should add other things, like abortion is constitutionalized under Roe versus Wade. And over the next 20 years or so, those policies are elaborated and consolidated and gain hegemony within institutions. And their effects on society become what I call consolidated. And then there's another spate of reform, and I think that also is in the early 1990s. and then, you know, which has expansion to the civil rights regime and, you know, the Violence Against Women's Act. And this is when there were real attacks on language, so that policeman is no longer said and fireman is no longer said. Somehow plumber can still be said, but I guess there's no plumber man in there.
Sorry to interrupt, but so what you describe here, like, you know, not being able to say policeman or the request to change these words, I kind of view that as woke culture. So do you view the woke culture as also like an offshoot of this movement, or you know, somehow related to this as well?
Yes, no, I think the woke culture is the latest revving up, the latest inflection point, and it is now probably being consolidated in America. So, yeah, that was going to be my third point of great, you know, expansions of reform. And so, yeah, I think it happens like in a cycle up, but it never goes back to where it was. It's always like a revolution that keeps going, achieving more and more goals. So yeah, totally. There are real parallels between how transgenderism is seeking to reform our language to what we saw in the 90s when feminism was seeking to transform our language.
Who do you think is the torchbearer today to Beauvoir or these feminists or feminists in general?
Say that question again.
So I'm wondering, according to you, who do you think is today's torchbearer to, let's say, Beauvoir or...
Oh, on the transgender issue?
Yeah, but also transgender, women's issues, woke issues, yeah.
Well, see, the thing is... that I just don't think there are torchbearers the same way. That since the ideology has been institutionalized, it's like there's this hierarchy with Beauvoir at the top. And then as generations go on, there's more and more advocates for her ideology. And they multiply, they spread out into different disciplines in the academy, different jobs in human resource departments, and, you know, just all over. So I look at her as the general, and today we're basically dealing with an army of corporals without any great, they're all living in the odor and within the ideology that Beauvoir announced, but I don't think there are like significant leaders in that program directing it the way that Beauvoir and some of the early feminists did here in America. So I actually, you know, in a book that I wrote in 2020 called The Recovery of Family Life, I talk about this and I talk about how feminism conquered the academy. And, you know,
University, is it?
Yeah, by academy, I mean universities. And they just did it discipline by discipline, subdiscipline by subdiscipline, so that, you know, each discipline has this big book, which you'd call like a torchbearer for the discipline. In political science, there was a book called Women in Western Political Theory, I think, by Susan Muller Oaken, 1979. And then all of us, like, wow, we have an intellectual leader in political science. And then for the next 30 years, academics, female feminist academics, would write books that elaborated on footnotes to Oaken. And now we're in like the fourth generation of this, where you have people elaborating on footnotes of footnotes. So on the one hand, feminism isn't as present as it was when Oaken was announcing the big torch-bearing book in our discipline. But on the other hand, it's everywhere. Affecting everything that is done and thought. And so it's like been disseminated in a very interesting, but also impossible to dislodge way. And so it's in the air we breathe, but you can't see it.
Why do you think, like, is it because ideas are more receptive in universities? Is that the reason you think feminist ideas did very well in, like, universities? Or do you think there are other ideas?
No, I mean, I don't think that the universities are that different from other aspects of society in this respect. It just happens to be the one that I know the best, so I just use that to illustrate the general point.
Understood. What do you make of the transgender movement?
Well, I see it as a natural outgrowth of this idea that woman is made, not born. And that it cannot really end up, it cannot be fought without a framework that takes on that assumption. My thought here is a little more complex than I just articulated, so let me try to put it as clearly as I can. I believe that the goal of the feminist movement was to cultivate a new kind of woman, what they called the independent woman, a woman who would be economically and emotionally independent of the family. The means that they used to achieve that was this goal, was this idea that the body has no effect on your destiny. Biology is not destiny. And that means was to achieve this new kind of woman. What transgenderism does is that it embraces the idea that biology has no effect on your destiny. The means to achieve what end? It's not as clear, except to say that the end is the abolition of gender as a meaningful category. So there is a relationship between the two. But there's also a political difference between feminism and transgenderism, because feminism has this aim of cultivating a certain kind of woman, whereas transgenderism obviously cannot even answer that question or speak in those terms. So they're deeply related, but also distinct politically.
How do you think this would pan out?
What's that?
How do you think this quote-unquote war or this war of ideas, how do you think this will pan out over the next decade or so?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, on the one hand, I assume that the rolling revolution that has been initiated will continue to roll, and it will roll over its opposition. So I think there'll be further efforts to sexualize children, and therefore withdraw their need for parental control or oversight, that they will try to establish and probably will establish national daycare. Maybe we'll go after the idea that parents can even homeschool their children. I think the movement is maybe too big in order to crush it, but nevertheless, it might be something that you'll see. So there'll just be further attempts to thin out the responsibilities that parents have in order to further emancipate women from the family and emancipate men from the family, I suppose. The question that we always ask is there some point at which it's too much? And I think the answer is yes, there is some point at which it's too much. And that point is when the lights get turned out in your civilization. So South Korea is the leading edge of this, which is why it's a very interesting location and place to think through the issues of the sexual revolution. But it's not going to end with a bang. I would say it just kind of ends with an unstringing of the bows. And that's kind of, the way I see things playing out over the next, couple generations.
Just to make sure I understood you properly, when you talk about the collapse of civilization, you're referring to the collapse of birth rate, right? Or am I missing something?
Correct. Yeah, the total decline in fertility rates, the lack of young children to renew and rejuvenate civilization.
Understood. I'm curious about your views on patriarchy. So let me just set this up a little bit. I think if you go to YouTube, I mean, no, I don't have audio, but generally, if people go on YouTube, I think patriarchy is widely considered as a bad idea or a thing that has to be kind of rethought and maybe removed. At least those are the videos that maybe I watch maybe. So how do you think about it? Are there good aspects of patriarchy? Are there bad aspects of patriarchy? Is the mainstream approach to patriarchy right or wrong? A lot of questions there. Maybe you can give your broad thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, what I have called for is a form of soft patriarchy. And so I would call there's a continuum between a hard and soft patriarchy. And the hardest patriarchy would be of the Roman variety, where fathers had the power over life and death, over their children, and at least in law, over in life and death over their wives. I think that's a really bad idea. And so if that's the hardest form, I'm definitely not on the hardest form of this matter. However, I think the project of attaching men to the family is an important project and requires social support because men are not as attached biologically to the family as women are. And if we're going to expect men to perform those tasks connecting them to the family, they're going to need some sort of social support and honor to do so. And if that honor is what we call patriarchy, then I think we need a version of that. So it's difficult to imagine there being a new kind of society where all elements of the family are gender free. And when you look at thriving civilizations, that is ones that reproduce itself, ones that have regular laws and customs, one where tomorrow resembles today in such a way that people can stably project their future, you'll see that there are some versions of sex roles that men and women play. And generally, like those sex roles are, women's are related to being mothers and wives, men are related to being providers and leaders of the house. And the honor that is afforded to men for playing that particular role is what I call soft patriarchy. There might be support in law, certainly in custom for such roles. That's what I call soft patriarchy. And the thing that we've learned, I think, is that without an institution like that, women themselves become less interested in marriage. And because they ask reasonably, where have all the good men gone? And they find that there are fewer there. So that's how I think about it. It's hard for me to imagine a great nation without great families, and it's hard for me to imagine great families without sex roles that are different between men and women, and it's hard for me to imagine such an approach to sex roles without the soft version of patriarchy that I just described.
What country, in your opinion, closely follows your idea of soft patriarchy?
I would say America for most of its history. Certainly during flourishing times, before the 1960s, it happened. But I would say that in its practices, America was still practicing such a version in the 1980s. Its laws were different, but its practices were like that. And you can still see that practice is very common among American Christian families. What scholar Robert Putnam, calls the neo-traditional family practices this, which is, you know, like just a kind of flexible division of labor between men and women, where women are more likely to take a few years off of working when their children are young. When they go to school, they might work part-time. and where men are the main providers. That's the neo-traditional family, still very commonly practiced in America. Birth rates are very high among people who practice that in modern America, and they're low among those who don't. And I think that's a very common finding across the world.
Any contemporary example?
Contemporary example? No. I mean, Israel is the closest you might get to an example like that. And it's a very religiously reinforced idea. But I think Israel is like a little harder, like harder patriarchy than the one I'm describing. But it's a successful, thriving political community that is reproducing itself, has the highest birth rate in the modern, like, industrialized world. And not simply because of the Orthodox, but also because of, you know, more traditional practices among secular Jews, where they think about what's good for the country and what's, you know, what their family traditions are and live within them. So, yeah, I think that would be the place where it's most prominently practiced in the modern world.
So from the beginning, I think I've only focused on you. I think throughout the end, you did bring up the implication for men. But what do you think has been the implication of the feminist movement on men?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is best captured in a book that I just reviewed called George Gilder, Men and Manners, but also in a book that he wrote in the early 70s called Sexual Suicide. And he says that men will either be, without the family, men will either be exiles or outlaws. And you see more and more of that, more drug use, more deaths of despair, more gang activity. That's the outlaw example. And the exile example is men without purpose, and, you know, serving a family and being honored for serving the family is part of what we used to consider to be a model male. And if you take away that model, then, well, what am I supposed to do is the question. And men have a difficult time answering that question. So I think those are the pathologies that come from having a feminist constitution.
Is there anything, I forgot to bring up a lot of things, but is there anything important that you would like to touch on before we close?
No, I'm exhausted myself, and
I don't think so, not with your energy. Anyways, Scott, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thanks for having me on.